think of Theodore Roosevelt, many images come to mind. President, Rough Rider, family man, hunter, conservationist, and much more. We often think of T.R. as a man's man who succeeded in life through his own hard work and determination. In the book, The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, The Women Who Created a President, author Ed O'Keefe explores the profound influence the women in T.R.'s life had on him, his career, and his legacy. Edward F. O'Keefe is the CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library Foundation. He previously spent 2 decades in broadcast and digital media, during which time he received a Primetime Emmy Award for his work with Anthony Bourdain, 2 Webby Awards, the Edward R. Murrow Award, and a George Foster Peabody Award for ABC News coverage of 9/11. Ed is a former fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he graduated with honors from Georgetown University. He was born in North Dakota and lives in New York with his wife, daughter, and son. Welcome, Ed, to the Talk About Teddy podcast.
Oh, Larry, Kurt, it is a pleasure to be with you.
You have written this very unique biography on Theodore Roosevelt from the perspective of the influence that the women in his life had upon him. You're currently CEO of the TR Presidential Library Foundation, and before that worked in journalism for a couple of decades. So how do you come to be interested in Theodore Roosevelt? You know, what's your TR story? And then in particular, what caused you to be interested in the role of women in his life?
Well, Kurt, I say in The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt that when you're born in North Dakota, you get your birth certificate and then your choice of idols, Peggy Lee, Lawrence Welk, Roger Maris, or Theodore Roosevelt. So I chose TR, or perhaps TR chose me. You all have spent some time in Eudora, North Dakota, what I consider to be one of the most beautiful places in the world, the Badlands, where Theodore Roosevelt spent those formative years as a rancher and a cowboy. I traveled through Medora practically every summer with my family. We would go to the Medora musical. We would spend time in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And I was a Red River Rough Rider high school. Rough Riders were my school mascot. And I always wanted to, I read everything and watched everything that I could about Theodore Roosevelt. But I never had the time, given the 20 years I spent in media that you mentioned, Kurt, to really dig deep and do some research and learn on my own about TR. And I've always been fascinated by the women in his life. I've heard legend of Bammy in particular. Obviously, I knew a bit more about Edith because she was First Lady. And I wanted to know more about them, but I started my research thinking that I would write a hopefully definitive account of Theodore Roosevelt's time in the Badlands, how nature was his healing tonic, and how, as he said, he would never have been president but for his experiences in North Dakota. I felt as a North Dakotan and somebody involved in building the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Western North Dakota, that was a perspective that could use more attention. As I started the research, though, I just kept bumping into the women. I mean, these extraordinary women in his life who are a part of every single major decision that he makes, both personal and political. And I respect the canon. I love the canon of work on TR. The rise of Theodore Roosevelt was like a Bible to me. I read it so many times. The pages are ripped and torn and dog-eared and underlined and penciled. But there are takes on Mitty and Alice in particular that as I got to know them through the original research and the letters, I thought, wow, these are very different people than what I thought I knew from what has been written about them. And all of a sudden, a new idea emerged. The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, the women who created a president, that this hyper-masculine man, who is probably the most masculine president in the American memory, is actually the product of these extraordinary women. And he's he's always, TR is that person that is supposedly self-made. And I love that image of Theodore Roosevelt. I admire that image of Theodore Roosevelt, the resilience and strenuous life that he lived. But it actually makes me admire him more, knowing that he had and needed help at many and various points in his life. And so that's how I came to write The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah, that's a great story. I mean, those of us who are blessed to have supportive women in our lives, that's a great perspective to look at this man that, like you said, the mythology is built up that he's self-made, or we hear so much about his father, Thee, being the greatest man he ever knew and such an influence, and yet you've almost turned that North Dakota slogan on its head and said, were it not for the women in my life, I would never have been president of the United States.
I think that's very true, Kurt. I think that's exactly right. And it's not to detract from Theodore Roosevelt's accomplishments. It's not to say that, Thee wasn't a great man. He was. Thee was an extraordinary example. But I think in building certain characters up, we've at times diminished the importance of others. And I think of history as storytelling, right? That each successive generation is telling a little bit different version of the story that they've heard before. And I've heard throughout my life that Theodore Roosevelt is the product of his own will, that he is almost supernatural in his ability to persevere. And I thought, wow, that's an example I want to live up to and a credo that I want to embrace. But as you go through life, you struggle, right? There are hurts and pains and death and challenge and sickness. And, you need your brothers, your mother, your father, your sisters, your colleagues, your friends, your spouse to help you through those moments. And even the great ones like Theodore Roosevelt had help. And I just thought it was appropriate in time to take a look at those people in his life that made him possible.
So you write that Mitty was in many ways the source of TR's greatest strength, his resilience. Can you explain that?
Well, I love Mitty. I think David McCullough might take a bit more charitable view of Mitty than Edmund Morris. I really looked to Mornings on Horseback, and I saw these glimmers of personality and liveliness. Fee's brother says when he marries Mitty, between your solemnity and her liveliness, you make an even pair. I guess it's a 19th century way of saying opposites attract, right? And, and you can imagine, right? Fee is solemn and serious and very dutiful. And Mitty is this Southern belle with incredible wit and personality. Her brother will say of Mitty that she is a bright-eyed, lively lass with a ready tongue. I mean, if you just took that quote, you could apply it to Theodore Roosevelt. And I think, indeed, TR's personality is much more Mitty's than his father's. I mean, he admires and loves his father, but if he takes after one of his parents more than the other, you'd have to arguably say it's Mitty. And Mitty, I think, as Thee is off, especially during the Civil War, working for the allotment system or the passage of what will become the allotment system, it's Mitty who's home with the children. Now, granted, she has help, but think about that. The people that are with her are Aunt Anna and Patsy Bullock, her mother. And so, indeed, really, the Roosevelt children are being raised by a retinue of women. And it's Mitty who's there cooling every fever, who's there, literally massaging Theodore Roosevelt's chest as a child so the blood can come out because he's hacking from such asthmatic attacks. That's scary in a time when childhood mortality was absolutely abysmal. I begin the loves of Theodore Roosevelt by saying, from the beginning, the survival of Theodore Roosevelt was very much in doubt. You know, this is someone who had to learn to fight for their life from the very first breath. And it was Mitty who was often there helping him, holding him, caring for him. You know, the stories of Thee are of cigar smoke and midnight rides and, you know, challenges to make his body as well as his mind. Yeah. Those are all wonderful things that obviously contributed to the psyche of Theodore Roosevelt. But it was his mother who arguably kept him alive.
Yeah.
Edward, your account of T.R.'s life at Harvard provides some insights into his youthful character after the death of his father sophomore year. Would you like to share a little bit about some of those findings and some of the sources that you use in telling that story?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, 1878 is an incredibly consequential year in the life of Theodore Roosevelt. On February 9th, his father, his beloved, revered father, will die at age 46, which is very young even for the time for him to pass away. And I would say somewhat unexpectedly in TR's view. You know, he goes back to college after Christmas knowing that his father isn't well, but it's in a way a stunning death. I mean, his father is taken from him when he's only 20 years old and really, you know, goes through this remarkable period of introspection and knowing that he's lost the most important influence, the person that T.R. will say, the only man in whom I ever confided my innermost thoughts. And then we'll simultaneously say, you know, we'll wonder about a wife. We'll say, I wonder who my wife will be, the only person that can replace my father, this person that I trusted and told everything to, is a wife, which is an interesting kind of calculation. It tells you he's 20 years old, right? He's depressed about his father dying, but he's also curious about living. And he wonders and says, I wonder who my wife will be, a rare, radiant maiden, which is, of course, directly from Edgar Allan Poe and The Raven. And to think about T.R. liking Edgar Allan Poe and admiring Edgar Allan Poe in 1878, that was not a commonplace view, right? Poe is disgraced at this point and really disregarded by at least literary history. So the idea that T.R., who certainly had a good value system, is seeing the already seeing Poe as one of the great literary minds of his generation is interesting in and of itself. And then, of course, you fast forward in 1878 to August 22nd and this mysterious, rupturous split that happens between Edith and Theodore, taking the walk-up tranquility, which, of course, was anything but tranquil because the Roosevelts were there. And, you know, whatever happened that day between these two that were supposed to be married, you know, did T.R. propose to Edith and she, as she later claimed, rejected him? You know, did he get a little fresh with Edith and she took offense? You know, was he presumptive with his bonus sister that everyone presumed would always be his? We don't know. History doesn't provide the answer. But something so bad happened between these two that they split and it seemed as though they would never come back together. And then, of course, you fast forward 2 months later from August 22nd, 1878 to October 18th, and there's Alice Hathaway Lee. You know, this beautiful, beguiling, progressive Boston Brahmin who must have just taken T.R.'s breath away, and suddenly it becomes Edith Who for the next 2 years. And, you know, it's just a remarkable formative year. I did a lot of research about Henry Davis Minot, his good friend in college. I think of Minot almost as a psychological mirror for Theodore Roosevelt. Mm. He had these people in his life that were, you know, Minot writes these excruciating letters about trying to find his manliness. You know, he drops out of Harvard and goes into the 19th century equivalent of, you know, of a sanitarium for a brief while to try to to figure out who he is as a person. And yet he has this very close relationship with Theodore Roosevelt. You wouldn't see T.R. and Henry Davis Minot necessarily as the best and closest of friends just because their disposition is so seemingly different. But I think that tells you something about how sensitive T.R. is and just how important natural science was to him as a potential career, which sort of gets to, you know, how Alice changed the trajectory of his life. But, you know, I could not have done The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt without some precedential research. I mean, A Most Glorious Ride, Edward P. Cohen putting together the diaries of T.R. I mean, just a remarkable contribution to the Theodore Roosevelt canon of work. Yeah. And by the way, that published right before the pandemic. So, I mean, I am literally shut out of any research facilities. I can't follow up on leads or piece together information. And there, remarkably, magically, serendipitously, is Cohen's incredible work.
Yeah.
You know, Betty Caroli and what she wrote in the Roosevelt Women, these lovely vignettes on each of the Roosevelt women, far beyond T.R.'s family, including the FDR line as well. And then I talk about it in The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt often and cite the book often, but I think Dr. Kathleen Dalton's work, A Strenuous Life, is for my money, the greatest single volume biography of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I mean, she really puts forward both academic heft and a narrative that positions T.R. in a way that I'm allowed to pick up where Kathy left off and build a bigger portrait of these individual women and their importance. You know, hers is a cradle to grave biography of T.R. built on 40 years of incredible, dedicated academic and scholarly research. And I'm able to, you know, take the parts of that book that are pertaining particularly to the women and try to expand and extrapolate what those women meant to T.R. So I stand on the shoulders of some pretty remarkable scholars and historians and writers in the TR canon.
Yeah.
Yes.
No question. It seems like everyone we speak with, Kathleen Dalton's work comes up as the definitive accessible one-volume edition of TR's biography.
Well, and I'll tell you, Kurt, I mean, Kathy was so incredible and so gracious to me. I was at Harvard after I left CNN. I was working with Anthony Bourdain on his program, Parts Unknown, obviously his tragic passing. And I find myself in Cambridge, and I reach out to Kathy. She not only aided and answered my questions, she invited me to her home. She and her lovely husband, Tony, we had lunch. She brought me down to her research. She said, whatever you need, you can take and photocopy or bring back. And again, during the pandemic, Kathy has this, you know, voluminous record of research through 40 years of her academic pursuit of TR. And I could reach out to her at any time, and she would have the answer I needed at the moment I needed it. So the Loves of Theodore Roosevelt is not possible without Kathy Dalton.
Wow.
Wonderful.
That is. Well, we had a question, and you've already answered it, I think, but in the book you quote from T.R.'s diary from 1880 that he calls Alice Hathaway Lee his first love. And you've already answered, so
No, I do not. I do not.
Yeah.
I love Alice. I believe that Alice was his second love and first wife.
Yeah.
And Edith was his first love and his second wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can certainly talk about it, but no two diametrically different women have perhaps ever existed, and yet they were both the wife of Theodore Roosevelt. And that is what I found also extraordinary about looking at Alice and Edith. You know, Alice is largely written off in most of the history of Theodore Roosevelt. She dies at 22, almost 23 years old. She is only with him for the sum total of 6 years, if you count the courtship years. They're married for barely four. You know, And there's just not a great historical record. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what is there, at the letters they did exchange, at the time they did have together, yeah. In Theodore Roosevelt's own words, he rose like a rocket when he was married to Alice. It is that yeah. Boston Brahmin progressivism of the Lee family and the Saltonstall family, who of course come into Theodore's life after the loss of his father. So in a way, they substitute, you know, Mr. Henry Cabot Lee and George Cabot Lee and the Saltonstalls, Leverett Saltonstall, they in a way become a substitute for what Theodore has lost. They're talking progressive politics, poetry, yeah. literature, all the things that he would have talked over with his father are suddenly there before him with the Lees and the Saltonstalls. That's all connected to Alice. I mean, it's an undeniable influence of this woman that, although there's not a great historical record, clearly meant an extraordinary amount to TR.
Yeah, so a bit of the letters that we do have that survives, there's this, what you describe as this infantilizing tone, and the words are almost embarrassing to read from Roosevelt, just this gushing language that he uses. But you say that she made him want to be a better man, that she changed him in ways that maybe history hasn't appreciated, and that also this process of winning her hand seems to have altered that TR's trajectory. Could you talk a little bit about
that? Well, sure. Well, Kurt, let's just stop for a moment and recognize that once again, Theodore Roosevelt learned this from his father, right? That so Fee will write to Mitty, do not become a strong-minded woman. And of course, Mitty, as ever, had other ideas. She was a strong-minded woman. She couldn't not become a strong-minded woman because she was a strong-minded woman. And in the same way that Fee will infantilize Mitty, Teddy, TR, will infantilize Alice. And it's interesting to see that pattern repeat between father and son, because I think Alice was very much like Mitty. I think, you know, she's strong-willed, she's vibrant, she's effervescent with life, she's beguiling, she's absolutely beautiful. I mean, one of the most eligible bachelorettes in all of Boston. Her nickname is Sunshine, right? When Alice dies, and we'll talk about that, I think, in a moment, right? The light has gone out of my life. He meant it both literally and metaphorically. Sunshine, Alice, had died. It's to imagine somebody that effervescent and present in life, that with that positivity and attitude, it would be quite dramatic if she were lost and taken from you as early as Alice was. But I think, you know, to answer your question, Kurt, about how it changed his trajectory, I was just under the earth at the Smithsonian with Darren Lund, the author of The Naturalist, and Darren was showing me these extraordinary specimens of the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History that, coincidentally, TR donated in 1882, because he's done with natural science. It wasn't a passing curiosity for him. He's 6 years old when he's collecting these specimens and doing taxidermy. He's interested in studying natural science at Harvard. Now, of course, you have to also say that at that point, science and the study of science is shifting to the laboratory. It's not out in the field. It's not the type of science that perhaps TR wanted to study, but really, the change in attitude is due to Alice and the Lees and the Saltonstalls. This progressive, reform-minded interest in politics and making a difference in the world, and frankly, having the means, having the money to afford someone as eligible and as desirable as Alice Hathaway Lee. He spends, and Edward Cohen documents this. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Edward, for going through the record. You know, the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of dollars in modern currency on trinkets and a horse and a dog cart and stable fees and entertainment and everything he can to win the hand of Alice. This is a 2-year absolute mad pursuit. I mean, imagine if you're Alice Hathaway Lee being the object of Theodore Roosevelt's affection. I mean, watch out, right? The same energy he will put toward charging up Devil Hill, the same energy he will put toward a record number of speeches on the campaign trail, he is putting toward one, as he says, all-absorbing object, Alice. He wants to win her. And so in order to do so, he had to change trajectory. He had to change the pursuit of his life from natural science to the law, and that naturally led to politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the book that the company owned by George Cabot Lee, Alice's father, was much involved with the beef bonanza. Do you think this influenced TR's decision to invest in cattle ranching in the Dakotas?
I do, Larry. I do. I think that it's almost irresistible in the conclusion. You know, George Cabot Lee and his business, as you say, is very heavily invested. Henry Davis Minot is involved, and his father is involved in the railroad expansion. I mean, Minot, North Dakota, is named for Henry Davis Minot, right? So here are two people who are in his life right around the time that he makes his first trip to Dakota, which is not, of course, in 1883. It's during his bachelor party in 1880. He heads out there with Elliot and just dips into what would become modern day North Dakota and the Minnesota border. You know, he's curious about this part of the world. It's as far as the train will go, but he's also got a father-in-law who's invested in this business, and he's got a friend whose father is very invested in the railroads. So yes, yet again, I think there's an unsung influence of Alice and the Lee family on TR's interest in and knowledge of the West.
Yeah. So how else do you think TR was influenced by Roosevelt's extended family?
Well, I mean, again, I think that it's almost hard to find a circumstance in which TR was not influenced by the Lees and the Saltonstalls at this formative period of his life, right? Let's just step back for the audience and talk about George Cabot Lee. I mean, I talk in The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt about how, you know, the most elite Boston families were politically active. They were reform-minded. They were, really thinking about the questions that would inform what TR's philosophy later become in terms of labor relationships, in terms of suffrage. I mean, let's just stop and think about suffrage for a moment. You know, Theodore Roosevelt is trying to win the hand of Alice Hathaway Lee, and in 1880, shortly after he announces his engagement on February 14th, he comes out with this incredible document supporting suffrage and equal rights for women. It says a woman shouldn't necessarily take her husband's name. He says women should own property. He says that women should become professionals, judges, and lawyers. This is 40 years before the 19th Amendment will pass. It's incredibly progressive. You know, and then you take a look at some of the others in the family. You know, I mentioned earlier that Mitty's mother, Patsy, and Mitty's aunt, Anna, are both living with the Roosevelts during the Civil War. I mean, you know, they're an incredible influence on TR as well growing up. I mean, he's growing up and is raised by a retinue of these interesting women who are always a part of his life. You have, being homeschooled with Edith. You have the books that they were reading together. You have the McGuffey readers. I mean, there's so many different ways in which that kind of extended family had an influence on TR. It's, again, almost irresistible in its conclusion.
Well, Edward, both Larry and I took notice of this same section in the book here where we're kind of we're building into Alice's delivery and then her death. But you write time and again, Roosevelt's reaction to change was the same. Run not to church, but instead to the cathedral of nature. With fatherhood impending, Roosevelt lit out for Dakota. When Alice and Mitty died, Roosevelt returned to the Badlands. Not to put too fine a point or trivialize this point, but when the going got tough in his personal life, Theodore Roosevelt went hunting.
You know, it's interesting, right? I mean, Theodore Roosevelt, again, is known for his courage and his bravery. And it's a well-deserved reputation. I mean, he will face... I like to say that after the death of Mitty and Alice, which I think you have to also extend the death of his father, right? He lost his father, his mother, and his wife in the space of 6 years. And in his time in Dakota, I believe Theodore Roosevelt had not a death wish, but a life wish. I mean, I think if you have a loss that profound so early in your life, you really begin to understand the fragile nature of existence, that this life is the only one you've got, and you've got to make the most of it, and you can take risks, and if they result in danger, then it's another way of knowing you're alive. Now, I think you combine that with what was obviously depression. I mean, the only person in his life that ever used the D word was his daughter, Alice, who would describe, you know, instead of dad is melancholy or blue or, you know, not quite himself, she said, well, he's depressed. I mean, he would had times in his life where he was depressed, you know, certainly after the loss of his wife and mother, but again after the 1912 campaign, you know, go through a pretty intensive period of depression. And, he knew how to react with courage in physical danger, but he didn't always know how to react to personal crises and tragedies of... I think that... You know, you'll see this again and again throughout his life. When Edith was quite ill after the birth of Quentin and before he goes to Cuba, you know, it's not the greatest moment for TR. And he doesn't really doesn't live up to the ideals that you would hope he perhaps would. But you can also imagine that he's got this memory, this searing, horrible memory of the death of his wife and his mother, and he just can't psychologically handle it. And the best thing to do for him to survive is to escape and to go to nature, to go hunting, to get out and not have to confront those feelings and those memories.
You know, going along with that, in your book you mentioned that TR is described as ashen by a colleague when he reads the second telegram on February 13th. And with that, could you tell us about the extraordinary account of Alice's delivery of baby Alice, as it was written by TR's Aunt Anna?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, let's back up to February 11th. February 11th is the date that TR decides he's going to go to Albany because, of course, TR being TR, he believes there'll be some poetic symbolism in the birth of his first daughter. Naturally, obviously, his daughter will be born on February 14th, Valentine's Day, which is 4 years to the day that he and Alice had announced their engagement. So he's got a lot of work to do in Albany. He wants to finish it up before the birth of his first child. It's, of course, customary at that time that the father wouldn't necessarily be, certainly not in the delivery room, so it's not unusual. But nonetheless, his mother isn't feeling well and his wife is due, and they've had quite a lot of difficulty getting pregnant. You know, later Edith will say that TR told her that Alice had some sort of gynecological surgery or intervention in order to become pregnant in 1883. So, you know, they didn't have children right away. So something, you know, there's reasons perhaps that he would not have wanted to travel all the way to Albany ahead of the birth, but nonetheless he does. And of course gets that first telegram, which delivers the news that That Alice is only fairly well, but that doesn't necessarily concern him. There's a celebration, there are cigars, and then that second telegram comes. Mm-hmm. We don't know the contents of the telegram, but we do know the reaction by another legislator who, as you said, described Theodore Roosevelt as ashen. He went white and he lit out of the New York State Assembly, went immediately to the train station, and a journey that should have taken two and a half hours at most takes 5.5 hours. Yeah. The New York Times described the fog that had descended over New York City as suicidal weather, that those that were prone to atmospheric conditions or depression should not even go outside because you couldn't see one step in front of your own face. You know, you couldn't see the boats out in the harbor. You couldn't see really where you were stepping in the street. And he gets off at Grand Central Station after that excruciating 5.5 hour train ride. And now remember, he's sitting there only with his own thoughts, and he has to be thinking of that train ride he took from Cambridge to New York City upon getting the news that his father was dying and doesn't make it in time. He doesn't make it to the deathbed of his beloved father. And here it is again. 6 years later, he is on an excruciating 5.5 hour train ride to New York City. He gets out and dashes up to 6 West 57th Street, where Elliot has said, "There is a curse on this house. Mother is dying, and Alice is dying too." Mm-hmm. Rushes up to the third floor, attends to Alice, and at 2:30 in the morning on February 14th, 1884, he's called to the bedside of his beloved mother. Mitty passes away in the very early morning hours of February 14th, and then back up to the third floor, TR goes, to hold and clutch in his arms Alice for 12 hours, refusing to let go until she too succumbs and dies at about 1:30 in the afternoon of the same day. It's unbelievable. And you know, I think Aunt Anna writes this extraordinary letter. She says, she describes the circumstance of the birth of Alice and says that when baby Alice is born, the doctor laments that it's a girl. And Alice says, "I love a little girl," and is able to hold her baby in her arms and is able to recognize that she has had this child. But of course, by the time that Theodore Roosevelt reaches her, she'll never again be conscious on this earth. And you know, it's interesting also, they named the baby Alice. You know, this thought that he dislodged her from his soul is really countered by the fact that she's named Alice. And I reveal for the first time in The Loves of Theodore Roosevelt another pretty extraordinary event. Well, I was at Sagamore Hill doing research with Laura Cinturati, this wonderful park ranger who was a caretaker and a curator at Sagamore Hill for many years. And we saw a record that said Alice Hare, 9 months, Alice Hare, 8 months. And she said, "Well, do we really want to see this?" I said, "I want to see anything and everything related to Alice, anything that exists, because there's so few things in the world left of hers." Mm-hmm. And so we pull this out, and it's a blue kind of teal, almost Tiffany-like box. It's not a Tiffany box, but it has that kind of color. And we opened it up, and there on the top was indeed the hair of Alice as a baby at 8 months, and then at 8 or 9 years old, and clearly in her mother's handwriting, that the hair was there. Underneath that was a very large swath of Alice Hathaway Lee's hair. And there was a note in Theodore Roosevelt's unmistakable handwriting that said, "The hair of my sweet wife, Alice, cut after death." So after the death of Alice, Theodore Roosevelt cut a large swath of his wife's hair. He took a small amount and they created a necklace for baby Alice to wear during her christening 2 days after the funeral at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian. And then Theodore Roosevelt kept that keepsake along with several pictures of Alice hidden in that box for the rest of his life and out of Edith's view. She never knew that it existed and never discovered it. It's been lost to history for all this many years.
Wow.
And I think it's almost, you know, that is evidence of the fact that Theodore Roosevelt did not indeed dislodge Alice from his memory.
Yeah.
In fact, it was so painful that he kept this keepsake hidden from Edith for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I've never heard that story before reading it in your book, too. That was kind of a real revelation to how people could have passed that up all those years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he dislodged Alice Lee from his soul. And I think yeah. Edith makes me think even more of Edith in a way. I mean, she was TR's second wife and had to live with that and had to live with the living embodiment of his first wife in the form of their stepdaughter, obviously caused a lot of friction in their relationship, which is a whole other fascinating point of discussion. But she also, you know, she had to live forever in the memory of a woman who would be 22 in Theodore Roosevelt's mind.
Yeah.
You know, I think they had such unique and incredibly loving and supportive relationship, a great marriage. But that backdrop and that tragedy preceding their marriage is just even, it almost makes what they accomplished together as a couple even more incredible.
We mentioned already that when TR was confronted with the status of fatherhood and being a widower, that his, instead of rushing headlong into it, he did the opposite. He ran. And when he left his daughter Alice with his sister Bammy, can you describe her extraordinary role and responsibilities that she assumed?
Well, Bammy, I mean, TR says it best. Bammy is the feminine Atlas on whose shoulders the whole world rests. I mean, for Theodore Roosevelt, Bammy was a substitute mother. Bammy was only 3 years older than TR, but somehow seemingly always the person who was there to help him do exactly what he needed at the time that he needed it. And boy, did he need her in 1884. I mean, let's not forget, Bammy had lost her father, and Bammy had lost her mother, and Bammy had lost her very close sister-in-law, too. I mean, she had experienced loss, but yet it's not Theodore Roosevelt who sells 6 West 57th Street. It's not Theodore Roosevelt who buys 422 Madison Avenue, and it's not Theodore Roosevelt who cares for the baby for the better part of 3 years. All those three incredible things are done by Bammy Roosevelt. You know, she is the one who really not only takes care of the family, and I mean, you know, you think the death of the father would mean that the new patriarch would naturally be Theodore Roosevelt. And it was, in a sense, but it was Bammy who did all the roles and responsibilities of the patriarch of the family to enable Theodore to really be the almost symbolic patriarch of the family. And they all funneled their energy into and toward him and his success. It's really extraordinary. I mean, Bammy is so selfless in her giving of her time and her energy and her intellect at every point. But no point more critical than 1884. And the other thing I'll say just quickly is Bammy knows she needs to let Theodore go and mourn and recover and be in nature, but she also knows how to bring him back. You know, she's writing, so 11 letters came into the purview of the Theodore Roosevelt Association. Lieutenant Colonel Greg Wynn, who now serves as the president of the TRA, extraordinary man, a good friend, and a wonderful TR scholar. You know, Greg was doing some digging in the archives while I was writing this book, and miraculously found 11 letters locked in a safe at the TRA that had not seen the light of day since 1954.
Wow.
Harvard called the discovery of those letters perhaps the most significant discovery since Theodore Roosevelt's death in 1919. So, And those 11 letters, I'll tell you briefly, several of the letters are from 1885, you know, the dark year in Theodore Roosevelt's life. He's not writing much in his diary other than what he's shot or what he's hunted. There's really no introspective reflection. There's no letters being exchanged with hundreds of people. So, we know what he's doing. He's recovering from the deaths at the Elkhorn. But what is he thinking? And now we have, for the first time, some of Theodore Roosevelt's thoughts in the forms of these letters. And there's an extraordinary letter from April of 1885 in which T.R. describes how after two horses take off from the Elkhorn, he has to take off after that, after two strayed horses, and he realizes he's left without any gloves or a hat. And a snowstorm comes in mm-hmm. so suddenly that he has to spend the night in a dwelling with a Texan cowboy, and realizes that the Texan cowboy has treated him first rate, and he's got a great admiration for the Texan cowboy. And then he talks about how this place is a restorative tonic, how he is feeling in the Badlands, and to whom is he confessing those feelings? Bammy. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's Bammy who knows. She's keeping him updated on political events back home. She's keeping him updated on national politics. She's describing some of the things that are happening. And when Bammy will discover, because she's not told by Theodore, when she discovers that that indeed they've been secretly engaged, she writes an extraordinary letter to Edith and basically says, "Look, Edith, it's so great to see that Theodore is re-emerging into the life he needs to be in, which is politics. Yeah. He needs to be in the public. He needs to be active in civic engagement. And you are going to have to share him with the world."
Yeah. Yeah, that's very insightful, I think, on her part. And I was thinking that, too, reading those your account of those letters. It must have been very satisfying for Theodore Roosevelt to report back to his sister, you know, all these manly, virile activities, almost bragging about the hardships he's enduring, how satisfying that must be to the sister who saw him suffer so terribly as a child. Must have felt like he was overcoming a lot of those deficiencies.
Well, and Kurt, you know, she suffered too. I think she had a spinal defect that was so serious that her grandmother Patsy would describe how Bammy could not stand for more than 30 seconds before a countenance of pain would come over her face. And, you know, I think it's from Bammy that T.R. learned to will his way through physical pain. Yeah. And I think, incidentally, it's from Mitty. Mitty adopted this philosophy after the death of Thee: live for the living and not for the dead.
Yeah.
I mean, that is resilience.
Yeah. Right?
That is the quality we most associate with Theodore Roosevelt: courage and resilience. And it is really from Bammy that he learned courage, especially over physical pain. Yeah. And it is from Mitty that he learned resilience, that life is for the living, not for the dead. You need to put one foot in front of the other, no matter what happens to you, no matter how bad it is, and find and fight your way through it.
Yeah. Yeah, that example of perseverance and endurance, I almost learned that more from her than any man in his life, it seems. One of my favorite quotes of T.R. is, "Throughout history, no man who ever lived a life of ease left a name worth remembering." And I think of Bammy there too. It's just with all these extraordinary ways in which she is leading the family, it's easy to forget all of the physical pain and suffering that she experiences every hour of her life. She's managing the supervising the construction of what's going to become Sagamore Hill while he's out in the Dakotas hunting, and she's you. This is really interesting. You compare Bammy's influence as a political strategist and advisor to Robert Kennedy's role with JFK. I thought that's a really interesting comparison to make.
I think Alice, the daughter, said it best. Alice Roosevelt Longworth said, had Bammy lived, had Bambi been a man, she, not T.R., would have been president.
Yeah.
And none other than Eleanor Roosevelt agreed with that assessment. I think the only thing that held Bambi back from accomplishing more in her time was her gender. And the fact that she selflessly put all of her faith and energy into her brother and pushed him forward in every way that she could. I mean, you think, you know, what's amazing, as I did the research, I was stunned. I mean, I had this argument and thought that Bambi was important, but I kept discovering things that I didn't know that she was connected to. It's Bambi who knew Richard Harding Davis and introduced Richard Harding Davis to Theodore Roosevelt while T.R. is police commissioner. Well, of course, Richard Harding Davis will go on to write about T.R. in Cuba, and then Connally will slip a lot of those stories back to the press and emphasize the importance of T.R. So here his sisters are quite literally working almost as RFK to JFK, political advisor and strategist and press secretary. You know, it's Bambi who meets Charles McKim and will introduce Charles McKim to Edith, and Charles McKim will become the architect of the renovation of the White House. Of course, it's Bambi who suggests to Theodore, you really ought to talk to Bellamy Storer about your lack of prospects. And it's Bambi who's exchanging letters with T.R. talking about the coming election and how perhaps if he's to get on board the McKinley train, he might find employment. I mean, she is architecting every move that he will make. You know, it's Bambi that supports the gubernatorial run. Bambi doesn't support the move to vice president.
No.
Edith and Bambi, they all think this is a terrible job, and it obviously was going to be, except for fate. And it's just really, I had a hard time finding a moment when Bambi or Edith or Connie were not involved in something that Theodore Roosevelt decided to do or not to do.
We hope you're enjoying this conversation with Edward O'Keefe, the CEO of the TR Presidential Library Foundation and now author of the newly released Loves of Theodore Roosevelt, The Women Who Created a President. Please keep listening to the next episode of the Talk About Teddy podcast as Larry and I continue this discussion with Edward O'Keefe as we look at this amazing cadre of women who had such a profound impact upon the life of Theodore Roosevelt.